In the new book, Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds, Tom Seaman, who went on to graduate summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa at Yale, nailed a perfect score in his LSATs and attended Harvard Law, looks back on his hard-scrabbled childhood in Toledo, Ohio, during the turbulent 1960s and 1970s. He doesn't sugarcoat his neighborhood encounters with bullies, dog bites, broken glass, and other dangers, or his moments of shame over secondhand clothes and food stamps. Yet throughout, he focuses on the simple joys of his community. Again, the name of the book is Animals I Want to See, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Tom Seaman to the roundtable this morning. Tom, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Joe. I really appreciate it.
What brought you to want to tell this story and tell this story in such a moving way?
Well, I'd say over the years, I'd been telling the story to people. And, you know, I remember being at a dinner party and someone said, everybody tell us where you came from. And, you know, people probably had an idea in their head. They certainly never would have guessed that this guy came from this giant family in the projects of Toledo, Ohio. So people were always really, really interested in the story. And I started to realize, oh, maybe I should write this down. And then I met Bill Clinton at an event, and he was very focused on my story. You know, a lot of people don't know, but his father died before he was even born, and he was raised by, you know, two strong women, his mother and grandmother, and also by an abusive alcoholic stepfather. So I think parts of the story rang really tightly with him. And so he said, you got to write this book. And so that was probably the catalyst that pushed me over the edge. You know, when you have a guy like that telling you it's a good story, you believe it. And so I wrote it, and he read it, and he gave me support for the book. So I'm really pleased with that.
You are 7 years old when you move with your parents and your nine siblings to a house on Bronson Street. And
yeah.
I'm interested in and why that particular move was so defining for you.
Yeah, so you're right. The book begins when I'm seven, and we only have nine children then. My mother goes on to have 12, of course, after we move. But we move from one area of the projects in Toledo, which is in East Toledo, to the projects in North Toledo. And I think it's a good time to start the book because it shows this transition from one place to the other. It shows the famous field behind our house, which is this, you know, overgrown, weed infested sort of field. But to me, you know, it's sort of the book opens up with this sense of wonder that I go out into this field, and rather than seeing all the junk that is thrown in the field, that I realize when I'm an adult, it's a junk heap of a field, right? But it looks vast, and it's really small when you grow up, but it looks vast when I'm a kid. And I turn over things and find like a snake or a rat, and I start listing the wild animals that I have seen. And I think this introduces me as a, you know, first of all, as a lister, as a sort of a thinker and organized striver. And later when I lose that list, I start a new list, which is called Animals I Want to See One Day. And that becomes the title of the book because it's sort of a metaphor for, you know, me and my hopes as a young child in the projects that I could actually one day get out of there and see all these animals around the world. But it's a metaphor for all of my other hopes as well, which is to be a success, obviously.
As you mentioned, there were 12 children. You were number 5 out of 12. I'm interested
yes.
in how, as you were writing this book, and even from your memories of your childhood, of how you felt your circumstances, your childhood was different than that of your siblings.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the interesting questions that, you know, I think about sometimes is the whole nature versus nurture. How much of my drive was born into me versus how much of it did I learn after my birth, you know? And I was driven at quite a young age to be successful in school, always get the best education I could, and just envisioning success later in life. You know, I have these dreams of becoming the heavyweight champion of the world or the president of the United States or the richest man in the world. And I think I was driven differently than a lot of my siblings. I mean, I have other siblings who were also good students, but probably my drive to get as far as I could in life stood out from them. I was also very competitive, probably to their annoyance at times when we were playing games. So I was probably the most competitive child. And I was one of the few children that really stood up to my father as well. Even my brother, who's a year older, he and I sometimes stood up to my father together. He even said to me the other day, you know, Dad picked on certain people the most, including you, because you stood up to him. So I think even he acknowledges that I was standing against that sort of stuff. So my siblings have all had their own version of success, but I would say, you know, the socioeconomic outcomes across my family is quite wide, you know?
Your father, as you put it, drank too much, and you say that really the kids rarely interacted with their father. He was happiest, if that's the term, spending time on the couch with a paperback and a cigar and a beer. So give us a sense of a situation where you would stand up to him and how that changed the dynamic between, well, ultimately you and your father, but even between you and your mother.
Yeah, that's a great, great question. There's a point in the book where my father pulls a gun on me, right? But that's not the episode we're going to talk about now. The one we're talking about now is when he sort of blocks my way out of the kitchen at one point, and we sort of come, you know, not to blows, but there's a little bit of physicality between us, and he goes tumbling. And the reason this episode is so important is it's not like I suddenly, or me and my brother, whatever, suddenly took over the household, but it was a moment of a sort of changing of the guard where my father was no longer fully in charge. You know, by then I was a big football player. I was much bigger and stronger than my father, who had, you know, ruled the roost and could say any mean things to my mother or do anything he wanted and control all of us and scare all of us for so many years. And after that, there were more men in the house and it wasn't fully his environment anymore, although he still was the leader, obviously, and still did what he wanted. But I think it was an important moment where he was knocked down a notch and realized he wasn't fully in control anymore. Yeah.
When it comes to your mother, as you say, a seemingly endless well of calm, 12 children in 15 years, and she really makes the impossible somewhat possible.
She is just an amazing person. She's still alive at 92 in Toledo. She's just an amazing person. She created magic out of nothing. You know, here we are on welfare, on food stamps, in the projects. We're a white family in a black neighborhood. There's a lot to deal with there. And she was committed to keeping the family together. You know, a lot of families like ours with a father like mine would fall apart. She was really committed to keeping it together. So the calm really played a role, I think, when my father, you know, would call her a whore and all these things. And by the way, the book doesn't focus on all these negatives. It's actually a happy story, a happy book, because I believe I had a happy childhood because of my mother. But when my father would deal with her that way, she would just calmly treat it as though, you know, oh, Harry, that's simply not true. You know, she would treat it almost as legitimate. And she told me later that was to keep the family together, to hold everything together so well. But in addition to all the hard work she had to do all the wash, all the dishes, all the cooking and cleaning for these 14 people, including herself. But she also went the extra mile. Like when she made meals, she would go an extra mile to make something special. When she sewed things, she would sew them. You know, she would do things that were beyond the norm. She would shine all of our shoes every Saturday night so that we had, you know, clean, shiny shoes for church the next day. I mean, she's sitting there shining all these shoes on a Saturday night. You know, it's just amazing. When I was at Yale, she would send me a, you know, a box with all this tape around it and stuff. And inside would be like a Maxwell House coffee can, which, you know, she used Maxwell House coffee, and it would be full of her baked desserts. And every time I got one of those, it would smell like coffee in addition to the cookies. And every time I got one, you know, I would cry, actually. Yeah. She would always go the extra mile.
What was it? Is there a time, is there a moment, is there a turn that makes that what you just described of a journey to Yale and then Harvard Law a possibility? Because people would look at your circumstances and say that is impossible. Earlier you talked about your mother making the impossible possible, but what was it about you that allowed that to happen and become a reality?
I think one of the biggest things was that I was driven towards so many things, but one of them was I always believed I should be getting the best education I could. And, you know, where that came from, I don't know, because all five siblings ahead of me went to the local public high school, which was not a very good school. And I was driven to go to to a private school, which in Toledo, frankly, means a Catholic school, because that's what they were. And we were Catholic, so it also made sense. And so when I was in the eighth grade, I determined completely on my own, I didn't pass it by my teachers or my parents or anything, that I could afford Central Catholic, the least expensive of the Catholic schools, by keeping my paper route, by working at the school if they would allow me, I assumed they would, and by doing the odd jobs I always did, like shoveling snow, et cetera, I could afford Central. And so I went to take the Catholic school's admissions test, and I checked Central to receive my results. And then I saw on there the other Catholic schools, and one of them is called St. Francis de Sales. It's the college prep. In my neighborhood, it was considered the sissy school because you wore a coat and tie every day. It was all boys. And I checked that box because I knew about that school being the college prep school, and I was always thinking about getting ahead. And about a month after I took the test, I was called to the principal's office, and there was a man there. And I thought I was in trouble being called to the principal's office, but the man was a priest from St. Francis. And he said, "I'm Father McMenamin. I want to know, why did you check Central?" And I said, "Central, because I can afford it." And I explained my calculations to him, and he was naturally impressed that I had come up with this. And I said, "I'm sorry, I checked the box for St. Francis because I can't afford to go there." And he said, "Well, let me tell you, you can afford to go there because I can give you a full scholarship based on your test results." So in answer to your question, I would say that was the big turning point, because once I get to St. Francis, I'm in the top class based on my test score. So I'm with the most academically successful kids. We're all competing to be ranked in our class, and I'm a very competitive guy. So I'm starting to have conversations at lunch with guys about world affairs and religion and politics, all the conversations I wasn't having at home and I wasn't having with my friends in the neighborhood. So a huge turning point, a very meaningful change in my life.
You were how old at that point?
So that's when I became a freshman in high school.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and if you remember, I was doing some bad things with my friends in the neighborhood around that time. So it also turned that, I think, you know, because you know you can go either way when you're in a neighborhood like that. You can go either way. You can go toward the bad or toward the good. And I think this whole St. Francis transition got me away from all that, got me out of the neighborhood, and got me headed in the right direction.
That perfectly tees up my next question, which was going to be about how you felt once you start to become successful. Is there a survivor's guilt that you have with your siblings, with your family, and those who you left in that neighborhood block in Toledo?
I mean, it's an interesting question. You know, fortunately, my siblings, you know, none of them is on welfare, none of them is in the projects, and none of them has a substance abuse problem, which is, I think, a fantastic outcome. And I think, you know, I know that we're a very happy family. We get together, all of us, for every Thanksgiving in Toledo. We all get along, like we're not all, you know, best friends with everybody because there's so many of us, but we have none of those kinds of relationships where so-and-so won't talk to so-and-so. It's all happiness when we're together. So I don't feel like I left any of them behind, and I do share some with them, you know, so I think that's all good. But as far as the kids in the neighborhood, that's, I think, a different question. So I don't know what happened to all of them, but, you know, some of them had bad outcomes for sure. But do I have survivor's guilt? I would say no. I would say I was driven. I worked super hard along the way. I drove myself hard to get good grades. I drove myself in the direction of success as I interpreted it to be. And I obviously had innate gifts. And the last thing I want to point out, by the way, that I haven't talked about yet is I really think the book is more like a collection of the small kindnesses that were done for me. So I had, naturally, a lot of help along the way, not just my mother, but from uncles and people in the neighborhood. You know, the guy across the street,
right,
you know, a black man took us fishing, and he didn't think that was going to change our lives. But if you add up all the small acts of kindness that became more and more apparent to me as I wrote the book, you know, it adds up to a life. And so I'm forever appreciative of the acts of kindness in the neighborhood. And then gradually, as I get outside of the neighborhood, that pushed me along. Yeah.
You mentioned Bill Clinton earlier and keying in and wanting you to pursue writing this book. But you also talk about meeting Jimmy Carter and what a formative experience that was for you.
Yeah, and the reason I included that was that Carter was coming to our neighborhood, and politicians back then didn't come very often to neighborhoods like ours, I think because they think that people in our neighborhoods don't vote, which I think was fairly true back then. It's less true now. But he came to the local public high school, and I went on my own to go see him. Just the point of, like, not saying I'm better than my siblings or anything, not at all. But I went, and my siblings didn't go. Like, I was always driven for stuff like that, to go and see and experience. I'm very experience-oriented. So that shows how my drive was different, I think, than the other kids in the neighborhood and then my siblings' drive.
And that isn't a case of the politics more than it seems to me than I have an opportunity to meet the president of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, if it had been a Republican candidate, I would have been there too, right? It wasn't necessary. Although his politics, obviously, he was this outsider who said really nice things about helping people. He seemed really genuine and honest. He wanted to clean up Washington, you know, the age old. But that was all new to me then, right? I hadn't heard these things before. So they were very, very interesting to me. But you're right. It wasn't necessarily about the politics. I was still being formed in who I was, and I would have gone to see anybody that was going there.
What do you hope people get out of the book, of reading this amazing story?
Well, I hope first they get a really good story, which I think it is. I hope they think it's well written, but I think the small acts of kindness that we can all do every day for others, I think you never know when your act of kindness is going to sort of add up to the others and push somebody through a wall or something or have a breakthrough. And I think that's kind of what my life was about. And so I try to do small acts of kindness or big acts of kindness every day for a stranger. And I think it's a discipline that helps the world. And it's a small thing. I didn't invent it, but I think it's amazing how it works. And it has the side benefit, I think, of making you a happier person as well. So, and I think the second thing I would say is, you know, in my darkest times, I would say what got me through was my belief that I could change my ending. And I think, you know, a lot of people are in hard times or facing things. And I think, you know, that human beings tend to believe the stories we tell ourselves. And if we say, you know, we have no hope versus, hey, I have a chance. If you tell yourself you have a chance, I think you're more likely to take action. And action doesn't always work, but it works better than no action.
Absolutely. Tom Seaman is the author of the new book, Animals I Want to See, a memoir of growing up in the projects and defying the odds. Tom, a great pleasure to meet you and to have you on the program. I thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me, Joe. It was really fun.
Be well. Thank you very much. Again, Tom Seaman's book is Animals I Want to See. The book is published by Post Hill Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.